The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'd like to ask everyone in the room, just by starting off, to take a moment and picture your favorite John Lithgow performance. Now, I think it's a tribute to the long and versatile career of our guest tonight that the heads in this room, I can safely say, are filled with dozens of different roles, each different from the next. Perhaps it's the Eagles tight end turned transvestite, Roberto Muldoon, in The World According to Garp, or the equally flamboyant, if far less benign, Dr. Emilio Lizardo from The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. Perhaps it's the more genial alien commander from the TV series Third Rock from the Sun, disguised as a Midwestern college professor. Yep. Maybe it's the chilling Trinity killer from the TV series Dexter. Yeah. Or the menacing assassin from Brian De Palma's Blowout, which for my money is the best movie ever made in the city of Philadelphia. Maybe on the other side of the coin, a terrified airline passenger from his section of Twilight Zone, the movie. Perhaps you've been lucky enough to see him on stage in his Tony-winning role in the Broadway musical Sweet Smell of Success, or if you have children in concert introducing young children to the Great American Songbook. His list of accomplishments is long. He's won 5 Emmys, 2 Tonys, and twice been nominated for an Academy Award. But they're mentioned only in passing in his book, Drama, An Actor's Education. Instead of running down a list of familiar roles, Lithgow focuses on the process of becoming an actor, which begins with being raised by Arthur Lithgow, an actor, director, and teacher who founded the Great Lakes Theater Festival and was, for 9 years, artistic director of Princeton's McCarter Theater, where some of young John's formative theater experiences took place. But there's no point in me recounting the book when we have the man here to do it for us. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome John Lithgow.
Thank you.
Oh, great. So, and just I think most of you are probably familiar with the format of these things, but we'll talk for a little while and then we'll throw it open to you for questions. So let me start by asking you just what the inspiration for the scope of this book was. As I mentioned, you know, people might pick up a book by you and expect to, you know, you just want to turn to the chapter on terms of endearment first or something like that. But you really, you know, are basically writing about performances that even some of the better-known theater productions, only sort of a relative handful of people have seen. So why?
Well, it's explained in the preface. Of course, the easy answer to every single one of your questions is just read the book. But the preface tells the story of the kind of inciting incident that led to the publication of the book. It was almost 10 years ago. I was taking care of my dad. He was age 86 and very unwell. He was recovering from a serious operation, and he was terribly depressed. And I took care of him and my mom. I stayed with them for an entire month and saw immediately that my number one task was not necessarily nursing him back to health, but simply cheering him up. All appearances, he'd lost his will to live, and I saw that I was going to have to just bring him back to life. And I couldn't do it. I mean, no matter what I tried, until I hit on the idea of reading him bedtime stories. And I found this big, fat book called Tellers of Tales in his bookshelves, which he had used to tell stories to me and my siblings when we were children. And that very night, I surprised him with the book. He and my mom were tucked into bed like children. And I told them to pick a story from Tellers of Tales. And they picked a story called Uncle Fred Flits by P.G. Woodhouse. And I immediately recognized the title, but didn't really remember the book. All I remembered, but it was always one of our favorites because it was so funny. But I started reading it dutifully, and it was like it almost exploded in my hands. It was such a genius piece of comedy writing. And as I read, more and more of it came back to me. I recognized all those things that we thought were so funny when we were kids. And as I read, my father started to laugh. And he laughed. The more I read, the harder he laughed. It was like the engine of an old car starting up after years of disuse, which, as you can imagine, is a line lifted directly from my writing. But it was my sense that it was during the reading of that story that he came back to life. And he lived another year and a half. And his health came back and his good humor. And I felt like this was the moment that a story had revived him. And he passed away, and years passed, and it sort of, it kept marinating in my mind. This epiphany moment began to crystallize all my feelings about what it is that I do, why I act, why I entertain, what it is that a performer does, and why people all gather around to watch this peculiar, mysterious transaction that human beings can't do without. It's such a stupidly simple question that we never ask it. Why do we need this? Because we really do need it. We can't do without it. We can't live without it. No culture can. And it just, those thoughts, the memory of my time with my father, the desire to pay tribute to him, he really was a remarkable man, and this extraordinary thing, this P.G. Wodehouse story, mm-hmm. and its incredible capacity to entertain people. I sort of mixed all that together and came up with a solo one-man show called Stories by Heart, which I did at Lincoln Center in 2008 under the auspices of Andre Bishop as a kind of two-night-a-week workshop. And word got around, it got wonderful press, it became the biggest little hit in town. And what was wonderful about it, I'd never written anything from my own experience to perform. This was the very first time. And I got such a wonderful response from, among other people, book publishers. I got the proposal to write a memoir, and it sort of opened me up to the idea. I'd never wanted or thought I was capable of writing a memoir. But because it came out of my show, when I set out to write this memoir, it became about, just as you say, the process of becoming an actor, rather than the things that I'm very well known for. I didn't know how to write a book. I set off kind of like Columbus seeking the New World. I didn't know where I was going. And the process of writing it began to define what the book was. I began to see that it was, as the subtitle suggests, an actor's education. All my experiences on stage and off that gradually turned me into both the actor and the person that I am by the midpoint in my life. And to try to make it as entertaining as a piece of theater, as entertaining as fiction, even though it's nonfiction and hopefully completely true. So that's the long answer to that short question.
Well, your father's laughter plays a key role in that story, and it also plays in the book. The element of laughter plays sort of the crux of you deciding to become an actor after having basically decided you wanted to do anything but kind of go into the family business. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell that story?
Yeah, it is true. The first line of the book is I started acting. The first time I acted was before I even remember, a little 2-year-old child, an extra in a production of The Emperor's New Clothes. I grew up acting all the time for my dad in his Shakespeare festivals in Ohio, but purely for the fun of it. I was much more interested in being an artist, and I only determined absolutely to become an actor When I went to Harvard, you don't go to Harvard to become a painter, God knows. But in fact, you do a huge amount of acting there if you're interested. And I fell in immediately with the theater gang. And because by osmosis I was a very experienced actor and an accomplished actor, I became a campus star like that. And Harvard is a unique place. If there's some area in which you're a star, that's what you do. Mm-hmm. Because it's so competitive. And in every other area, I felt so inadequate. And I had this extraordinary experience in my sophomore year in, of all things, a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, and an obscure one at that, Utopia Limited, in the role of King Paramount. Raise your hands if you've ever seen or heard Utopia Limited. There's one person. But the Act 2 opening number of that show is a famous Gilbert and Sullivan showstopper, famous to, you know, people who know they're Gilbert and Sullivan, tiny little gang. And sure enough, I completely stopped the show as the sort of the main performer of a septet. It was a ridiculous patter song called Society Has Now Forsaken All Its Wicked Courses. The refrain is, it really is surprising what a thorough anglicizing we have brought about Utopia's quite another land. In our enterprising movements, we are England with improvements which we dutifully offer to our motherland. This won't mean a single thing to you. I'm not even sure the audience knew what I was saying. But for some reason, I completely stopped the show. They applauded and cheered so long and hard, the other six men left the stage. And they wouldn't let me start the next scene. They just cheered and roared. The longer I stood there like an idiot, the louder they applauded. And I say in the book, it was probably lasted only 20 seconds, but it felt like 10 minutes of applause. And it was during those 20 seconds that I decided to become an actor. You know, if you hear enough applause and laughter at a young enough age, there's no way you can avoid being an actor.
Right. Obviously, the audience reaction is something that's unique to live performance, unique to the theater. Do you miss it when you're doing film or television?
I do. Of course, I mean, this is comedy we're talking about, and movie comedy is much more difficult than movie drama. It's why so many comedies fall so flat. You don't have the rigor of entertaining an audience. You don't truly know what's funny. It's why movie comedies need so much test marketing and test screening. Whereas on stage, you hear immediately whether you're funny. It was such a point of honor for us on Third Rock from the Sun, where we had a very supercharged studio audience, that we really entertained them and we really make them laugh. If you couldn't make those guys laugh, you knew you weren't funny. And all sitcoms with a laugh track or where you hear laughter, there's some canned laughter sort of sprinkled in to just get you through the edits and things. But it was a point of honor with us that we kept the canned laughter to an absolute minimum. We loved the sound of live laughter. So, and of course, drama is something other, completely different from that on film. But I think the same is true. An audience sort of keeps the performance honest. Mainly what I prefer about the stage, as much as I love acting in movies and TV, what I prefer is they're with me. I mean, you're telling a story and they're experiencing it at the same time. So in its way, it's just as important to you on stage as it is for the people out there, and it all happens together.
Right.
And it can be, you know, as an actor, you're constantly waiting for these moments of a kind of electrical connection with an audience. And you simply can't get the intensity of that when you're just acting for a camera.
Right. I'm always curious just about television in general. Even, I mean, you've done some, you know, I think fairly long stage productions, but even, you know, the longest stage production is maybe, you know, you think a year and a half, 2 years playing the same role. I mean, that was, I don't know, 6 years, 130 some episodes of, mm-hmm. of that show. I mean, how does, I don't know, how do you sort of stay engaged in the process that long, and what's it like inhabiting a character for that period
of time?
You
know, Third Rock was remarkable, and I've tried another sitcom, and I just sort of knew it's never going to work as well as it worked on Third Rock. It was, a lot of it had to do with the fact that it was so theatrical. It was very high energy. It was a bunch of theater actors, and we worked very intensely and intently with the writers, which was very, very exciting. It was a very creative experience every week, just inventing a 22-minute one-act farce. And I think that's what kept it. It never got boring. Sometimes it got a little crazy toward the end, but it never got boring, and it was never less than fun, mainly because you're trying to invent laughter all the time. Just imagine laughing for a living. I mean, that's what we did.
Right. I'm trying to remember. I can't remember the exact phrase, but perhaps you do. One of the Emmys you won for that show, I believe. You almost sort of apologized to the other nominees for. They showed some clip of you doing something, and you. Remember what you said?
Yes, I considered that my best acceptance speech. It was my third Emmy, and I thought this is getting ridiculous. But I got up and said, honestly, I don't know why I've won this award. As far as I can see, every actor in Hollywood thinks that what I do on Third Rock from the Sun is completely disgraceful. I mean, you saw it up there, and I'm referring to this. I even imitated myself. Good for you! I said, I'm embarrassed myself. But in fact, it was a joke. And I was extremely proud of Third Rock. From start to finish, I thought it was a masterpiece that never actually got credit for how brilliant it was. I mean, the writers, for example, were never nominated for anything.
Right.
And it was absolutely brilliant comedy writing. It was like George S. Kaufman never getting credit for writing for the Marx Brothers, because everybody thought they were too zany and were making it all up, and they were a bunch of crazy comedy anarchists.
Right. Well, and it was one of those, I mean, great sitcoms. I mean, just the sort of tightness of the ensemble. I mean, you felt a real kind of camaraderie and a sort of, I don't know, interconnectedness between the actors.
Yeah.
It was really wonderful
working with them, particularly Jane Curtin, Joey Gordon-Levitt, who's become this marvelous big movie star, a source of great pride for all of us.
Yeah. I wanted to go back to Shakespeare, and just that you mentioned your father's devotion to Shakespeare, and you sort of, you know, appearing often as a, you know, spear carrier or you know third page from the left or something in various productions. I mean, is there something, obviously growing up with theater gives you an appreciation of the art, but I mean, is there something, you know, specific about the sort of steady diet of Shakespeare, anything that had a sort of prominent impression on you?
Well, Shakespeare is extremely demanding, especially as my father produced it. This was in the 1950s. I finally played substantial roles and really worked for him in 63 and 64 when I was about 18 and 19 years old. But he performed, his festivals were out of doors with no amplification. So it was, I mean, you had to be so loud, you had to have so much strength, kind of acting muscle. And that was one element. And the second was the fact that, you know, with Shakespeare, what Polonius says, you know, pastoral, historical, comical, Shakespeare wrote across the spectrum. The same person who wrote King Lear wrote Comedy of Errors. He wrote tragedy, farce, and these complex comedies, As You Like It, Twelfth Night, even more complex comedies, The Winter's Tale, Tempest, it's almost surrealistic fairy tales like Cymbeline and Pericles with astonishing characters. And my dad produced summer festivals where there would be seven productions running in repertory, which means you're playing a different role every night, and they're extremely different, and they're painted in broad strokes because you're performing for people 40 yards away, out of doors, and they've got to hear you. So it's made me a very big actor. It's made me a very muscular actor, and it's made me more of a theater actor than a film actor, mainly because there has hardly been a film I've ever been in where the director hasn't told me, oh, just take it down a little. You know, I'm so accustomed to it by now. In fact, that's always been my sort of modus operandi, is to just give it all I've got and wait for him to tell you. It's like providing Michelangelo with a piece of granite and saying, go ahead, chip away, chip away. But I mean, I think that came out of Shakespeare.
Right.
And believe me, Shakespeare was about it. It's pretty much all I knew, not only of acting, but of theater at all. I remember seeing a production of Death of a Salesman in New Jersey. I went with my dad because one of his actors was playing Willie Loman. And it was the first time I'd seen a naturalistic play in my life. And it was like, whoa, theater can be this, you know? And it had a huge impact on me, if you can imagine, a 14-year-old seeing Death of a Salesman anyway. But to grow up on a steady diet of theater and to see this completely different kind of theater at such a young age, it was amazing.
Right. I mean, you mentioned in the book, I think it's on your Fulbright application, which you got. I think it's they ask for your aspirations, and you say, you know, American Repertory Theater.
Yeah.
Right. I'm, you know, just curious about the sort of, and you mentioned the sort of doing seven plays in rep, and that's, I think less of a sort of common discipline now than it was then. But I mean, what did, I don't know, being in that environment and just, and having to, you know, sometimes as a director and a coastal director, actually having to cast people for seven roles at once and having to, just having the experience of seeing actors kind of change every night.
Well, it was pretty unusual back then, too. Mm-hmm. It's far more unusual now. The whole idea of a repertory company is very rare. But my father believed in it deeply. He sort of modeled his companies on Shakespeare's troops. Mm-hmm. And you could see, you know, if you look at Shakespeare, you can see that there are lines of roles that were clearly written for one actor. You know, the actor who played Iago probably played Iachimo in Cymbeline, or the actor who played Hamlet probably played Orlando. So yes, there was that, you know, sort of growing up with that sense of what theater was. When I wrote American Repertory Theater, when I was heading off to England to study at Lambda after Harvard, when I was ready to study acting in earnest, that's really how I saw myself. I guess I saw myself doing what my father had done, working as an actor manager in regional repertory theater. I sort of never imagined myself on Broadway, let alone in a movie, let alone on a sitcom, let alone even living in Los Angeles. To me, that was a kind of other profession altogether. So going to Broadway, being in a movie, being in a sitcom, winning Emmy Awards, it's like one thing after another has been a huge surprise to me.
Right.
But I still think of theater as the taproot and what my original intention was all along.
Right. There's so many stories in the book of you, you know, working with, encountering, you know, various people who are much better known now from you know, acting alongside Tommy Lee Jones at Harvard to, you know, working with Bob Fosse and Meryl Streep. I'm curious, what have you learned from working with or being around bad actors?
Well, there's an entire chapter devoted to working with a bad actor. I use a pseudonym. It's called Mr. Pleasant, which was the name that the movie crew came up with for him, because he, to all appearances, he was such a sweet guy. But in fact, he was running everything. And my first experience with a true diva You do learn plenty from bad actors. You probably learn most of all from bad writing, because that's where you learn how to save your ass. But certainly the best directors and the best actors are the ones you learn the most from.
Right.
Good examples are better than bad examples.
We'll turn in that direction. there's a couple parts I just wanted to sort of ask you for your memories of. I mean, you mentioned, kind of starting at 10 and letting the directors whittle you down, and I think you'd agree from the way you write about it in the book that your part in Buckaroo Banzai is about as close as 10, staying to 10, as you've been able to do.
That was, it was the most, certainly the most extravagant performing I'd done on film. There are two performances on film which are virtually theater performances. One is that, and the other is the Twilight Zone episode. Right. The Twilight Zone episode came first, and to me that was my big breakthrough because it was directed by George Miller, a fantastic Australian film director, fresh from Mad Max and The Road Warrior. He's actually a brilliant director. He just won an Oscar a couple of years ago for directing Happy Feet, all things. But I loved working with George, and George was the first director who did not go, take it down. He said, more, more. He always wanted more. He said, he would say things like, I want to see your face crack. You know, it's like, it's one amazing story about him. It's a longish story, but it's worth it. He wanted, when I don't know how many of you saw the, raise your hands if you saw the Twilight Zone episode. Yes, it's very popular. At the moment when I finally saw the monster, only 10 inches from my face through the glass of the window, he wanted my eyes to expand to the size of tennis balls. And he decided to help me achieve that effect, obviously. He had this prosthetic makeup genius create a fake face for me just in this area with two pneumatic eyes and a bladder, and a bladder in the back, so that at that moment, he got the camera all set up. I had to sit around for about 5 hours completely blind with this weird fixed look on my face, like... You know, and then he just set up the cameras for this one moment, and they rolled the camera, and they squeezed the bladders, and my eyes went, and everybody said, okay, that's enough of that. Thank God that's over with. They figured the whole thing was, because the whole crew thought he was nuts. And he looked at it in dailies and came back the next day and said, oh, it was great. It was great. The only trouble was, it wasn't the same time. We have to do it again. And everybody thought, oh, God. Literally spending a whole half day on this. They finally got to the point where the eyes went, that's all he needed. And if you watch it on DVD or VCR, just pause it at that point and you'll see three frames of film where my eyes are that big. Well, that's the kind of director for me, It's like, that's what he wanted from my whole performance. It's fabulous to do that and yet completely inhabit it, make it that big and that real. And I think only a theater actor can achieve that. That, you're always looking to play some part that you feel you can do better than anybody. Like, go ahead, break the mold. I've already done it. That's how I felt about The World According to Garp. Just something that one I own. Well, I think that's how I feel about a lot of my acting and film. I know perfectly well people think of me as an over-the-top actor. That's their sort of default impression of me. And it's why I end up cast in so many bizarre and over-the-top roles. But I feel, fine. That's what I bring to the party.
Right. I think there's going to be a run to the nearest video store for Twilight Zone.
It's really fun.
Well done. And I wanted to ask about, you worked with Brian De Palma on a number of occasions. I mentioned Blowout as one of them. I think that's the most times you've worked with a film director?
Yes, I did three films for Brian, right. And that's two more than, well, I guess I've worked a couple of times for Bruce Beresford, but
right.
But most often with Brian.
And he played, it wasn't his film, but he also played a key role in getting you into film in the first place.
Yeah, in the first place.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there something sort of special about that relationship?
Well, it's funny you should ask. I got a call from him only a couple of days ago. I was in San Francisco. This has been a crazy couple of weeks, let me tell you. And Brian had read my book, and he was just thrilled, because I write a lot about him in the book, and I asked him, how accurate was I? He said, absolutely, you got everything right. He was amazed how much I remembered. And a lot of it, I wasn't even there when the event happened. He had described it to me, mm-hmm. and I remembered his description. Brian was fantastic, was and is. Actually, one of our films was here. That was Blowout here in Philadelphia. He was so Hitchcockian in every way, not just the fact that he was into macabre psychological suspense thrillers. His entire demeanor was Hitchcockian. He had the same Hitchcock process of completely designing, almost over-designing his films. He could show you his film on the computer with stick figures before you even started shooting. Long before people were doing this very, very sophisticated computer-generated storyboarding, Brian was way ahead of the game. This was 1989 when we did Raising Cain. He showed me entire sequences of stick figures. And then he would just sit back and watch us act out. You know, as Hitchcock always said, the shooting period on a film is a necessary evil. And Brian was very like that. He would just sit there with iPods, earbuds, and listening to music between takes, just like, oh, when is this going to be over? And yet, you know, he hired the best people. And he was a very good friend of mine. I was always his best friend on the set because everybody was so scared of him. But we'd been friends before I ever worked with him. We were friends at age 22 or so. So, yeah, he's great.
Yeah, and I can see how an actor coming off the theatrical background might sort of see more eye to eye with him, where it's very much about sort of constructing parts that fit into a larger whole and taking satisfaction and being part of that machine rather than having a sort of subjective experience on the set or waiting for your close-up or something like that.
Yeah, he relies on you completely to deliver. I mean, it's just your job.
Right.
He was very cut and dried about it. The other filmmaker quite like that was George Roy Hill, who did World According to Garp. He wasn't quite such a gloomy Gus, but he was also tremendously well-prepared. We rehearsed for 2 weeks. We even did run-throughs of The World According to Garp, a run-through of a movie script on our feet in a rehearsal room. Unheard of. It's because he came out of live television in the 1950s. He, Sidney Lumet, Sidney Pollack, people like that.
Right.
Great old-timers, and we'll never see their like again.
Right. Okay, with that, I think we'd like to turn it over to you for some questions. So most of you probably know this, but the way this is going to work, there are people in the aisles with microphones. We'll call on you. Please wait until you have a mic before asking your questions, since this is being recorded for posterity. Right over there, sir.
I've seen you in many, many, many of your acting performances in many venues. There's one that stands out to me because of your range in it, from your serial killer to your facade putting on for the rest of the world in Dexter. And I thought it was just a great, one of your best jobs. How do you consider it?
Well, thank you so much. I actually was very proud of Dexter and had a wonderful time doing it, which must make me an extremely weird person. I mean, it was a diabolical character. it was the ultimate villain. But what fascinated me, what made it such a pleasure to me, was the complexity of the role. The fact that he was a killer who was so deeply compelled to kill, but hated himself for it, didn't want to do this. Like, stop me, somebody stop me. He even kind of pushed people into apprehending him and stopping him. So that when Dexter finally kills him, I guess I've passed the moment of a spoiler alert. he lay there relieved that it was going to finally happen. To me, that just gave such color to the character. To even attempt to elicit the audience's sympathy for the devil, it just made it such a complex role. And I think the other thing about it is there are two roles that I've done on television, very notable and noticeable roles, Dick Solomon in Third Rock from the Sun and the Trinity Killer on Dexter. And the Trinity Killer came second. So that people's kind of reflexive reaction to me was this kind of doofus, you know, this clueless, foolish, zany comic to make use of those expectations, to play a character, as you say, who presented himself to the world as a very innocuous kind of ordinary good man and good citizen, to hide the fact that he has had this horrific self-loathing and this terrifying other life. To me, the tension between the two and upending people's expectations from what they already knew of me as an actor, it was great. It's like I had the opportunity to just scare the hell out of people.
I'm curious because part of what makes a TV series work is that there's a great deal of continuity both in front of the camera and behind, same cast members, same crew, same writers. I wonder what it's like to come into a show like this, that, you know, not only come into it in its fourth season, but have a role where I think, apart from, you know, bumping into Keith Carradine, you have no contact with any of the regular cast members for half the season.
Yeah. It was fascinating. It was beautifully constructed. An amazing kind of unfolding puzzle. The way the story just sort of, the shoe kept dropping, and there were all these astonishing surprises on the way. It was a very small role for the first five or six episodes, although that first scene made it terrifying every time I showed up. And only at that point, when I finally meet Dexter, and the two of us become these unlikely friends without either of us knowing where the other one came from. I mean, it became this fascinating psychological puzzle. I didn't know he was lying to me, and he couldn't figure out what in the world I was doing.
Right.
It was, and the way they just strung that on. And you knew that this moment was going to come when the Trinity Killer finally figured out who Dexter was. And sure enough, when it came, raise your hands if you haven't seen that season of it. Well, I seriously recommend it. I'm sure you're not. If you haven't seen it, that means you're not Dexter fans. See it.
Right.
I'm just telling you, it will take you on an unbelievable trip. And thank you for your question.
Right. And Michael Hall, obviously, is another actor with this pretty profound theatrical background.
Yeah.
Well, so.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Over there, sir.
Yep. Hi. I had a quick question. I can't remember the name of the movie, but when you played Blake Edwards,
yes.
How difficult is it to play I think he was still alive at the time. How difficult is it to play someone who's either recently passed or is still alive to get into that role as opposed to a historical figure from 100, 200 years ago?
It's strangely unsatisfying. I'm not crazy about playing characters that are already familiar to people, and to feel the obligation to do as accurate as possible an imitation of them. I've played Blake Edwards, I played Abraham Lincoln and FDR. In every case, I had this feeling, you know, everybody knows that this is pretend. What an actor is constantly looking for a suspension of disbelief, and that's hard when people have a strong impression of the real person. I mean, Frank Langella pulled it off in Frost Nixon amazingly well. But to me, it's not quite as satisfying because you're not quite as new. I should add, I'm going to play a figure from real life in my next job, which is a marvelous new play by David Auburn, the writer of Proof, next spring in New York, called The Columnist. And it's about Joseph Alsop, of all people. Now, raise your hands if you know all about Joseph Alsop. See, this is the good news. There aren't very many people who know a lot about him. But 50 years ago, he was an incredibly important American figure. He was the most powerful and well-known journalist in America. And he had an incredibly complex personal life and personal emotional makeup. Who cares how close I come to imitating Joseph Alsop? Nobody knows what he looks like. Even the people who know all about him don't really remember what he looks like or what he behaved like. So it can be a brand new creation for people, and it's an extremely important story. And I find that very liberating. Playing Blake Edwards just didn't mean much to me. And he was very, very upset that he was even being portrayed at all. He was very unhappy with the script until the film was already open. I mean, when it was finally made, he was delighted. He thought I was wonderful in it, and he did more press for it than I did. It's like,
okay. What do we go all the way back there?
Hello. I confess I did not know that you wrote children's books. I'm very curious to know what inspired I'm a Manatee and a little bit about your experience writing it.
Oh, what a nice question. Thank you for asking. Yes, indeed, I do write children's books. And there's a chapter in my memoir. I realize I've talked almost not at all about my memoir, but it's good and you should read it. That's all.
There's very little overlap.
So yes. I'll tell you a little bit about my impulse to entertain children. The chapter is about my baby sister, Sarah Jane, who's 10 years younger than I, with no siblings in between. And when she was growing up, I was 10 years older. When I was 15, she was 5. When I was 17, she was 7. I was her, junior varsity parent. I entertained her, and I adored her, and she adored me. We were a wonderful sibling pair, you know. The chapter is called Big and Little because that's the name we had for each other. When I had my own children, I continued playing all the games with them that I'd played with my little sister, and they led to entertaining children, doing concerts, doing CDs, doing big orchestra concerts in Carnegie Hall and with the Chicago Symphony and the Pittsburgh. And of course, writing all these children's books. Children are a fantastic audience to entertain because they're a completely different animal. This thing I said about seeking a suspension of disbelief, with adults, you never achieve it. They always know they're sitting in a theater and they're looking at a proscenium and they're looking at an actor pretending. Not kids. They don't know where they are. They barely know it's a theater. And they accept everything they see without the slightest irony and no distance. It's just glorious to entertain them. I mean, they're very difficult because you can't lose their attention for a moment. But they believe everything with such passion, and it's so important to them, you know. And to me, it's this wonderful counterpoint to entertaining adults. And so I keep doing it. I do it and do it and do it. And as for the children's books, I was touring around the country with my concert of silly children's songs, And I was performing in Columbus, Ohio at the zoo at an amphitheater. What a ridiculous thing for a grown-up man to be doing, but there I was. And a huge crowd of families had gathered to picnic on the grass and watch my concert, and there was this huge cloudburst, thunderstorm, and everybody scattered and sought shelter, me and my musicians included, and I found myself sheltering in the Manatee Pavilion for like 40 minutes, waiting for the rain to stop and watching the manatees swim around. And I began to think of all the different words that rhymed with manatee. And that was the inspiration for that book, that song. I'm tempted to sing the manatee song. Shall I do that? Raise your hands if you've ever heard of the manatee song and the book, I'm a Manatee. From time to time I dream that I'm a manatee, undulating underneath the sea, unshackled by the chains of idle vanity, a modest manatee, that's me. I look just like a chubby brown bananity as I nose along the cozy ocean floor, immune from human folly and inanity. That's why a manatee is such a happy herbivore. I'm a manatee, I'm a manatee. I'm every bit as wrinkled as my granity. No difference between my face and vanity. A noble manatee, that's me. With the dietary habits of a manatee, I never fail to lick my platter clean. I sprinkle seaweed on my raisin branity. The perfect manatee cuisine. With my wit, sophistication, and urbanity, I dignify my watery domain. No one near will ever hear me use profanity, because a manatee has his image to maintain. I'm a manatee, I'm a manatee. I keep my reputation spick and spanity. No difference between my face and vanity. A stately manatee, that's me. Encumbered by my lumbering giganity, I'm thought to be an ocean-going brute, the least appealing creature on the planetee. But to a manatee, I'm cute. I prefer my world of silence and of sanity, but my underwater friends don't all agree. For whenever I am dreaming, I'm a manatee. Somewhere a manatee is dreaming that he's me. I'm a manatee, I'm a manatee. Outside the fold of boring old humanity, no difference between my face and vanity. I'm a roly-poly, jelly-roly, sugar-boly, heart and soul-y manatee. That's me. Now, that I did not expect to do tonight.
Right, so, questions, song requests, anything, sir, over there?
Hi, welcome to Philadelphia, or welcome back, as the case may be.
I feel very well.
Tough act to follow that. I remember seeing you a couple of years ago on hosting the movies on Turner Classic Movies.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering how much input did you have in selecting those, and what do you look for when you yourself go to a play or a movie for entertainment?
Well, I look for exactly what all of you look for, to be entertained, edified, moved. I look for all of those things in stories and plays and movies. That was a very nice gig. The TCM people are just fantastic. What they don't know about movies is not worth knowing. And I did it for two seasons. It was a Sunday night, more or less a family movie kind of thing. It was called Essentials Junior. And the first year, I I was very involved in picking the movies, but I picked a lot of movies that I loved when I were a kid, which were way over the heads of kids. Things like Gaslight, you know, and Notorious. So it's like, what? But I had loved those movies, and they indulged me 1 year, but the following year it was all, you know, things like Swiss Family Robinson. But they were all lovely movies to talk about because they all really were good films for children. As far as input, I watched the movies again or for the first time, as the case may be, and very much talked off the cuff in front of the camera. So it was far more, they didn't write for me at all. I just talked about the movies.
Right there.
Hello. Terms of Endearment is one of my favorite movies of all times. However, I remember watching an episode of Third Rock where you did that famous scene of Shirley MacLaine's, except substituting squirrel, I think, for daughter.
That's right.
So I was really curious, and I was floored when that happened and so delighted. I just was wondering how that came about. Was that your idea, or was it improvised?
No, it was the writers. Everybody thinks we improvised all of Third Rock, but no. It was one of something like four or five opportunities I had to do parodies of my own movies. I mean, in that case, it wasn't a parody of my performance. I was parodying Shirley MacLaine. It's very, very funny. I'd run over a chipmunk, and I was so racked with guilt that I got way too involved in the veterinary care of this chipmunk. And I came running out into the sort of nurse's station of this veterinary hospital yelling, "Give my chipmunk his drugs!" You know, and it was just so funny because everybody recognized it. But there was the first time Dick Solomon ever rode on an airplane, and he looked out the window and said, "There's something on the wing of this plane!" And it was the engine. when Tommy created a rock band, a garage band, and woke me up in the middle of the night, and I came storming in, I said, "Rock and roll music!" It was right out of Footloose, like verbatim. And best of all was when Dick Solomon was so desperately curious about what went on in Mary Albright's women's group that he dressed in full drag and sat there just and got terribly, terribly involved. Well, that was Roberta Muldoon. You know? And it was just one of the great tropes of Third Rock from the Sun that I could actually parody myself and get huge laughs out of it.
Yeah, great. I think we have time for two more questions, so we'll do right up here.
Are there artistic challenges or longings of yours that remain unfulfilled?
Well, I'm asked that question a lot, and there really aren't. I leave myself wide open for other people's brainstorms. There's a couple of things. I would love to do some major work in Shakespeare. It's a curiosity that I did 20 Shakespeare plays by the time I was 20, and I've done three since. Only two in the U.S., and the last of those was in 1975. I did go to England and worked with the RSC about 4 years ago playing Malvolio, but I feel like it's almost my duty to go back and do some major work in Shakespeare, and I will do that. But in general, I would say all my great experiences have been somebody else's idea. And many of them have come to me, and I've thought, "Oh my God, I can't do that." And somebody has said, "Yes, you can." So I've taken it on, and I have surprised myself. It is a truth that people often see potential for you that you don't see for yourself. They see you in things that you can't imagine yourself doing. And in my case, every single time has been a major breakthrough. So I'm waiting. If you have any good ideas.
Right up here. Yeah,
right, she's right here.
Yeah, sorry.
Can you talk a little bit about M. Butterfly?
Yes, M. Butterfly was an incredible experience. again, it sort of arrived after the statute of limitations on my memoir. That was in 88. And as I say, as Sam has told you, my memoir ends in 81 and 82. M. Butterfly is usually the answer to the question, what has been your favorite experience? The reason being, it was an astonishing play. David Henry Hwang, it is his great play. He's written many wonderful plays before and after, but that one is his statement. And it's a ringing, passionate statement from an Asian American writer, an Asian American male. I would say of everything I've done, there's never been anything that has had such a powerful intersection between complex ideas and complex human emotions. The ideas had to do with the West's misperception of the East, men's misperception of women, Western males' misperception of Eastern females, David Hwang's own experience as an Asian American man in American society, the U.S. misguided policy toward the rest of the world, particularly the East, and particularly in Vietnam. All these extremely challenging ideas, all of them from a brand new point of view. Nobody had seen a play on Broadway or practically anywhere else written by an Asian American with an Asian American's point of view. So for so many people, it was like, this extraordinary kind of implication. Oh, my God, yes, that is my prejudice, and I didn't even know I had it. That's one aspect of it. And the second half of this intersection was the emotional impact. For those of you who don't know, M. Butterfly was about a French diplomat who fell in love with a Chinese opera star and carried on a 20-year-long affair with her, without learning that she was, number one, a spy, and number two, a woman. I mean, a man dressed as a woman. And, of course, based on a true story, but David just extracted what he wanted from the story. He never asked the question deeply, how could this have happened? He just took it on face value. But it was written with such passion, and we played it with such passion. A man completely devastated by this revelation that the woman he loved had actually deceived him on these one political and one the most primal personal level. That realization on the part of both characters was completely devastating, emotionally devastating to the audience. And amazingly, even though everybody knew what M. Butterfly was about, as far as we knew, half the audience every night was taken completely by surprise in the last 10 minutes of the play when they found out the truth. You know, I've never had an impact on an audience like that. And John Dexter's just enthralling production, so wildly theatrical with its use of music and dance and movement and lighting and setting. It was just extraordinary. So,
well, as Mr. Lithgow mentioned, there's much more in the book, so pick yourself up a copy upstairs and please.
Thank you. Thanks for the question.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.